About a year ago, when President Obama created the Council of Women and Girls, he said, "The purpose of this council is to ensure that American women and girls are treated fairly in all matters of public policy." He also said, and I think this is the key in understanding civil rights in the year 2012, "The issues facing women today are not just women's issues. Likewise, the issues facing African Americans today are not just issues of race. The issues facing immigrants are not just those of immigration. The issues facing gay, lesbians, and transgendered people are not just issues of gender orientation and equality." As Dr. King once said in the language of his time, "All men are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality." There's no better spokesperson for this network of mutuality than Anita Hill. And my quotes and my references today are from her new book called Reimagining Equality, which was published recently by Beacon Press, which, as you know, is the Unitarian Universalist publishing house. And I recommend it to you, and if anybody would like to borrow this copy of it's first come, first serve, if you would like to borrow my copy of it. When you think about that network of mutuality and how women's issues are no longer simply women's issues, think about the connections that Anita Hill's life has exemplified. Clarence Thomas had been a judge on any level for less than a year before he was nominated for a position on the Supreme Court, and his character was given as a primary reason for his advancement. But the women's issue of sexual harassment did not move the Senate Judiciary Committee sufficiently. There were all men on that committee, chaired by, remember who? Joe Biden. Because Anita Hill was disregarded, Clarence Thomas became a Supreme Court justice by a vote of 52-48, the smallest majority of any judge in the 20th century. And because Thomas became Supreme Court judge, George W. Bush was elected president by a 5-4 decision of that same Supreme Court in the closest presidential election in history. The issues facing women are not just women's issues. Reimagining Equality begins with Anita Hill's own family. Her great-grandparents were all slaves in Arkansas, as was her maternal grandfather. A generation later, the family moved to Oklahoma because land had become available to them. How? It was taken away from the Native Americans and made open to homesteading. Anita Hill was the youngest of 13 children. In the early 70s, when she went away, the first of her family to go to college. And when she was going away on that scholarship to Oklahoma State, she was given a set of luggage, tattered, used luggage, by the retired black school teacher who had been her mentor. It was more than just luggage for her, it was also a symbol between generations of moving on, moving up, and remembering where you came from. And Anita Hill has done all of these things. She tells early on how important it was for slaves to have the power legally to become married. Slaves could not become legally married. And it was very important for that new generation of recently freed slaves to become married and thereby gaining the rights of marriage, the privileges of marriage, and the recognition as members of the community that marriage entails. Marriage was a path to freedom, into citizenship. Yet, for whatever reason, Anita Hill does not ever mention gay marriage as an issue, even though it's clear that gay people are seeking exactly the same thing in wanting to be legally married that the slaves sought over a century before. She also talks about how important it was for her grandparents to own a piece of land, not merely to sharecrop as they had been in Arkansas. And her grandfather, who had been born a slave and was free, and acquired some land in Oklahoma, each year would take out a loan for seed corn and grain and to feed his livestock. And each year, the loan became bigger and bigger until he woke up one day and understood, much to his surprise, that he had lost his farm. He spent the rest of his life sharecropping again. He had been mortgaged back to sharecropping. So, as we see, this will not be the first time that poor folks lost their home through predatory lending practices. Most of the book is devoted to explaining in very concrete terms with personal examples of poor folks that lost their home through predatory mortgages. This part of the book is really excellent. She also goes back to the play that became a movie called The Raisin in the Sun, which is about exactly the effect of a black family wanting to own their own home and what it did for and to the various members of the family. She speaks about a single black woman who takes out her first mortgage, and the mortgage for 2 years was $841. At the end of 2 years, the mortgage jumped to over $1,700. Not an unusual situation at all. And she makes the point that so few of the people who took out the predatory loans actually understood what they were getting into. And sometimes you kill people, well, how could you do that? And do you understand your mortgage? If you haven't, you hired a lawyer that cost a lot of money to represent you against the other guy's lawyer, and you sort of crossed your fingers and hoped that your lawyer was going to do that job. I only have a master's degree in divinity and majored in philosophy. I have no idea what that mortgage is saying to me. And a lot of the people that took out these kinds of mortgages didn't have any legal help. They just literally took it on faith. She points out that over half the mortgages in black neighborhoods are made to single black women. She sees this as a crisis for women that is not just a woman's issue, clearly. She tells of a mother who bought her home and moved to a neighborhood partially to protect her children, and then her teenage son was killed, accidentally shot dead on the streets of her neighborhood. And this is a woman's issue and a man's issue and a human issue. She also reports the racist component in how these mortgages spread in the black community. There is a number of testimony, mostly of former employees of Wells Fargo, on the way these mortgages were marketed, and that they very intentionally look for the most vulnerable in the population, the uneducated, the elderly, and the overeager. And that banks would hire mortgage brokers in poor communities, often finding them in the black churches. When I lived in Milburn, I worked out at a hardcore gym on the border between Irvington, Maplewood, and Newark. And except for me, most of the people who worked out there, Josh Thompson was a member there, were either cops or rap artists. And it was really kind of hard to tell which was which, you know. But one of the things that was really funny, all these rap artists, they would bring their CDs and they would play at the gym. It was like, whoop, whoop, whoop. And then they'd be in the shower and they'd be all singing gospel songs in the shower. But one of the guys that was actually my trainer for a couple of years, it was a minister in a black church in Newark. And he worked while he was a minister as one of these mortgage brokers. And every time he got a mortgage signed, he got a check for $10,000. Boom, boom, boom. And he said, at first I was told this was a way for poor folks to own their own home. And then after a while, I saw what I was doing and I couldn't do it anymore. I just couldn't do it anymore. And he said, it was just like dealing dope. You get the big white guy outside of the neighborhood who hires people within the black community who are either ignorant or unscrupulous, who prey on their own community. It was just like dealing dope. In the year 2006, over 25% of all loans were subprime loans. In that same year, the CEO of Wells Fargo earned $53 million. The book has numerous examples of how the housing crisis has devastated all neighborhoods, especially black and poor neighborhoods. And in the black neighborhood, it's been almost as though there were another round of urban renewal, again cutting the heart out of the community. But it affects all neighborhoods eventually. The issues of black folks are no longer simply racial. My mother passed away in 2006 in rural Ohio. And I put her home out to auction. There was one bid. It was for the minimum that I wanted. And I sold it, and there it was. It was done. 2 years ago, or 2 years later, in 2008, one of my high school buddies' mother, in a much more suburban, upscale neighborhood outside of Toledo, went into a nursing home, and he had to do the same thing that I did. This was 2008. He has yet to get a bid on that house, a single bid. It's a much nicer house than my mom's house. The reason he's failed to get a bid is he's competing with foreclosures. And so he's just sitting there, living in California, paying taxes on this house, this really nice suburban house, and it surely used to be all white. If it's not all white now, it's the next closest thing to it. And it's really leave it to Beaver country that we're talking about where that house was. So it's not just in the poor black neighborhoods. I think a lot of people in this country were disenfranchised of home and job right at the time a black person was elected president. Remember Andrew Young said, the country's so screwed up they let one of us run it. So they did the same thing with the cities. After they screwed up the cities, they let us run it. You know, we mentioned Jackie Robinson, the first black baseball player. There was an interesting thing in the New York Times recently in the obits, you know, the annual, the magazine section that's all obits. This year they did basically common folks. They didn't do their celebrity stuff. And one of it was a really interesting article because the author started looking at all the obits of black folks who were first. You know, not necessarily the first Major League Baseball player, but the first black librarian in Birmingham, you know, or the first black machinist in Pittsburgh, you know, and all these folks who are like in their 80s and 90s who had been the first of their race to do things and remembered in their families and their communities as the first. And being a baseball historian, I know how difficult it was for Jackie Robinson. He was specifically in an agreement not to retaliate his first 2 years. And then after that, he was on his own. And he got criticism from black folks those first 2 years for being so passive. And then he got criticism from black folks after that for being so aggressive. But you know, Jackie Robinson's got his own stamp and everything, and everybody wears number four. You know, you kind of forget that Barack Obama's the first president, in a way. You know, where has he gotten any benefit of the doubt? And you know, I think being the first president might even be tougher than being the first baseball player. You know, I think it might be. I don't know. And you know, I think he's called a socialist because the old name that people want to call him is no longer socially acceptable. And to the white liberals who have been disappointed in his performance, I say, having been a Unitarian minister for over 30 years, when have white liberals not been disappointed in a president? And of course, let any of us walk for one day in his shoes. If civil rights in 2012 requires a new definition, Anita Hill makes the point that it also requires a new definition of home. It was actually when Herbert Hoover was Secretary of the Treasury that he started the move toward individual home ownership as being the American dream. That's where it got started. And for many years, it has been that. But she makes the point that the mortgage single standing house is an old American dream, but we need a new American reality where people understand the obligations and also the beauty of living in an inescapable network of mutuality. That the stronger the interconnections of all institutions in a neighborhood, the less vulnerable any of us are to predators of any kind. And this is where our church is really an important part of that network of mutuality that forms a community safety net when other kinds of safety nets may not exist. And that's why we're reaching out and building relationships in places like Luna Stage or Planned Parenthood in East Orange, with the University of Orange, which teaches so many of these same values, with LAMBI, the group that Marcial Bonham is the head of that meets here twice a week, with the New Jersey Institute of Social Justice, whose executive director will be here February 5th. This is what we are doing to help redefine what home means. That so much of what we have been taught is required to be at home has been destroyed or out of reach. But there's deeper aspects of home, an inescapable network of mutuality that we must recognize. And that is how civil rights is done in the year 2012. May we join together.